Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. And for this next hour of the Mark Steiner Show, we are here live at 410-319-8888. And we'll be talking with Jackie Savitz, in the beginning of this program to talk about what's going on in New Orleans. She is the Senior Campaign Director for the Pollution Campaigns at Oceana. And then in the next half of the show, we'll be talking with Crystal Hayes, an anti-racism activist who wrote a really incredible piece at racetalk.org that we'll be talking to her about. So stay with us for that. But first, let's send you over to WEA traffic. Make sure everyone gets home nice and safe. We'll come back to our conversations. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We are going to have a number of interesting conversations in the course of the hour. We're going to start with Jackie Savitz, who rejoins us. She's Senior Campaign Director for the Pollution Campaigns at Oceana, the largest international organization focused solely on ocean conservation. Jackie, welcome. Good to have you back with
us. Thank you.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Before we talk about the President's Conference and what you thought of that, and I was very interested in the article in the New York Times earlier this week where a number of oceanographers were quoted as being upset because they were not getting the data from BP. The government wasn't getting the data from BP to analyze, to find out just to the extent of this oil release and the damage it was doing. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. You know, there's been a lot of issues about transparency in this process ever since it started, whether BP was giving us everything they had, and obviously also about, you know, whether there was an accurate estimate of how much oil was coming out of the well into the ocean. And that's been going back and forth. The government has said that they would like BP to make all the information that they have available to the public. They obviously wrestled BP into making the live video public, and you can now see that online in a variety of different places. But it's very important that this information is transparent because this is how we can, first of all, understand the tremendous impacts that the ocean is being forced to absorb right now, but not only just for our understanding publicly, but also as we go forward and try to assess the damages that BP is causing. We'll need to have this information so that can be done accurately and completely. And so that's why it's so important that we get this information. And from what I understand, in the example of the Exxon Valdez, which we all keep looking back to,
right,
there were issues with whether or not data were made available, even subsequent to the spill, that were important in assessing damages both to natural resources and also to the public.
I was really kind of shocked to hear this morning. Well, not shocked, because it takes a lot to shock me. But when I was listening to Democracy Now! This morning, and Amy Goodman, she had on one of the leaders of the Shrimp Fishermen's Association, who were among the many thousands of fishermen out there, hundreds of fishermen who were cleaning up the bay and going out there.
Right.
And he said, besides the fisherman who went to the hospital because of breathing in the toxic fumes and air, I suppose, that they were not allowed by BP to wear masks, oxygen masks, respirators, while they were working. BP told them if they did that, they would be fired.
Yeah, you know, and the thing that strikes me about this is, you know, as you alluded to, you know, the fishermen are really the big losers in this whole story, and they're not able to make a living the way they normally would. Obviously, this is also true of some of the local restaurants and the hotels, but even restaurants, you know, here in Maryland that, you know, serve Louisiana seafood. Everybody's, you know, losing out of this deal, except, you know, we weren't the ones that wanted to take the risk. But there's a real irony there that it's the fishermen who have been basically knocked out of a job through no fault of their own that are forced to go out there because they have no other choice but to try to make a living and expose themselves to these toxic chemicals that the oil industry has now dumped into our oceans and onto our coast. I just see a real irony there because then they're putting themselves at risk yet again, even though they've really already been penalized.
I wonder what your analysis is of the press conference today. I'm sure you watched it.
Well, we were actually in a hearing during the press conference on Capitol Hill talking mm-hmm. about the oil spill. But from what I've seen in the president's statement, we're really very happy to see some of the moves that he's making. We don't think it's enough, obviously. Mm-hmm. Some of the closures that he's put out there are temporary. We think they should be permanent. But a couple highlights that are worth noting. The first is the drilling in the Arctic that was scheduled to happen just over a month from now was a real concern for Oceania because, you know, it's hard to think of a worst-case scenario than what we're seeing in the Gulf right now, but if there was one, it would be the Arctic. A spill like this happening in the Arctic, in cold water, rough waters, with icebergs floating around, and during a time of the year where we have near-complete darkness up there, and we don't have the response capabilities lined up there that we have in the Gulf. So we were very concerned about this exploratory drilling that Shell is about to start. And the fact that the president has at least postponed that, of course, we think he should call it off, but maybe this is a step in that direction. So we saw that as a high point. We're also very concerned about the drilling off the coast of Virginia, and especially those of us who live here in Maryland in the Chesapeake Bay region. You know, drilling off the coast of Virginia could bring us a Deepwater Horizon disaster in Chesapeake Bay, and then we'd have more fishermen out of work and more restaurants and hotels hurting. And so he, from what I understand, is canceling that sale, which I think is a tremendous victory for all the residents of the Chesapeake Bay region and beyond. And he's also said that he's putting a hold on additional deepwater drilling for at least 6 months, and, of course, we hope, again, that that will be permanent. And we also think he should go another step further and just stop all drilling and take his commission and ask them to think about, you know, how do we get to a point where we don't need to be drilling for oil and gas in the oceans by combining things like conservation, energy efficiency, and clean energy technology. Maybe we could actually break this addiction, and wouldn't this be a good time to do that? And if we do that, then we can actually start building the infrastructure to be the exporters of the energy technology rather than importers. So there's a lot of good economic reasons to be going that direction.
A question about that, and then I'm going to come back to what we know about what's happening in the mm-hmm. Gulf and how this is really affecting the Gulf and the animals and fish that live in the Gulf. But when people in the environmental movement say, and people who are fighting for the environment and fighting for a different kind of energy source in our world and to stop using fossil fuels, there should be no more drilling. And when you hear President Obama say, look, it's going to take us a long time, 20 years, more, to convert, and most people I know say the same thing, but to convert from a fossil-based economy, fossil-based fuel economy, for what fuels our industry and life, to any kind of alternative energy really being the major source of our energy needs. It's a huge transition that any society has to make. It's not going to be able to just happen. So then you say, but no drilling, then where does the oil come from during the process of transitioning? I mean, how does this – this is something that it seems to me that the yeah. president should be bringing all these people to the table to kind of figuring out what this means.
Yeah, this is really the disconnect, I think. And this is where I think, you know, we as an environmental community lose a lot of people. And, you know, I would like to see the president, rather than saying we can't and we need 20 years, I'd rather see him sit some of his smartest people around a table and think about how much, if we do any new drilling now, how much oil are we really going to get? When are we going to get it? Because drilling, of course, is, you know, a long process. It doesn't, you say start new drilling now, you're not going to be getting oil probably for at least another decade. In that time, what could we do instead? What kind of energy efficiency could we do? How could we electrify the fleet? Could we be building offshore wind? And if we spent that same amount of time building those clean energy technologies that produce three times more jobs than fossil fuels, then maybe that's the transition we're talking about, because we're going to continue pumping oil out of the Gulf of Mexico. We understand that. But do we need the new drilling, which is going to take time to pay us off? Or can we figure out a way around it? You know, there's a great story. Our office in Juneau, Alaska, experienced a couple summers ago, their hydropower went out. I think there was an avalanche or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to switch over to diesel power, which was much, much more expensive. And so without any kind of laws or requirements, the citizens of Juneau figured out they didn't want to pay that much for their energy. So they all cut back, and they significantly reduced their energy consumption by like 20%.
Hmm.
Now, if they can do that in Juneau, which is a place where you obviously need, you know, your heaters and things, You know, and I'm not saying we all have to cut back our heat, but there is potential there that we're not going to realize unless we decide to try to do it. And when they got their hydro back, from what I understand, they didn't immediately, you know, go back to 100% of what they were using before. So there is room for us to say, all right, we're going to continue pumping oil out of the already drilled wells. There's 35,000 wells in the Gulf of Mexico right now. We're continuing to pump out of them. We're not saying we're going to stop using oil tomorrow. But let's say we didn't drill any new wells. How much would we be talking about? Could we replace that with energy efficiency and clean energy technologies and conservation? And if so, why would we want to ask our oceans to take another, you know, huge risk as what they're taking now? Because we know that once we're drilling, and there will be an accident, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, there's nothing we can do about it. And we're really seeing that very clearly right now.
Because while the technology for drilling, I mean, it's pretty much the same as it's always been. It's just bigger drills and more regulations about how to drill deeper. That we still don't have any technology. We have not advanced technology about cleaning up spills. We're still mopping it up.
Yeah, we mop it up. We don't get very much, maybe 10%, maybe a little more if we're lucky, of the oil actually comes up. The rest of it gets left for Mother Nature to deal with, and that takes a long time, takes a lot out of our living resources. Obviously not a really good solution. So if we don't have a solution, why are we taking the chance?
So tell me about what we know about what is really going on. I mean, in this spill right now, we've just seen new estimates come out today that the spill is much larger than we expected. That we're not quite sure what it is, but it's clearly larger than BP has been telling us.
Yes, and this has been a number that's been in dispute all along.
Right.
First, it was 1,000 barrels a day. Then it was 5,000 barrels a day, which translates into 200,000 gallons a day. And then there were some scientists coming out saying it could be a lot more, maybe 10 or 20 times that. So now the estimate that we're seeing is that it turns out we were underestimating it by a factor of 3 or, you know, so maybe 4. So they're saying now it's not the worst number that we've heard, but it's certainly not the 5,000 barrels that we were looking at, which means that we've already seen much more oil than what was dumped into the ocean during the Exxon Valdez.
And so what do we know from what scientists know about the results of any of the testing being done of what has happened in the ocean? What do we know?
Yeah, that's a good question, because obviously we'll never know the full impacts of the spill, because a lot of the marine life that's been exposed, and they've been exposed since day one, there's been a lot of effort, I don't know if it's by the oil industry or if it's just the way we think, to say, oh, well, it hasn't gotten to the coast yet. And it's only when it got to the coast, I think, that people started getting really, really concerned. But the animals that live in the ocean, the fish, the sea turtles, the marine mammals, they've been exposed to this oil, this toxic oil, since the first day it started spilling, which is now over 30 days ago. And, you know, for example, we have marine life that are very important commercially, such as bluefin tuna, which is a big sushi, expensive type of sushi. Bluefin tuna, Atlantic bluefin, only spawn in two areas in the world. One is the Gulf of Mexico, and the other is the Mediterranean Sea. And guess what? It's spawning time, and the oil spill is in their spawning area. So we actually, this is an overfished species. It's down to about 10% of its original population size, and it needs a successful spawn. And guess what it finds when it gets down to its spawning area? It finds this toxic soup of oil and now toxic dispersants that are also mixed in. Now some drilling muds. We'll put a couple pinches of drilling muds on top of that. So this is not a good thing for the fish larvae, and obviously the larvae are the most sensitive life stage. We also have 5 species of endangered sea turtles. One is threatened, 4 are endangered, who are down there for nesting. It's their nesting season. They nest on the beaches. So if the oil doesn't get them when they come up to breathe, the question is whether they'll be able to nest and whether their eggs will be able to hatch, make their way back into the ocean, and then get out into the Gulf Stream where they're going to start to grow up. So these are endangered species who, again, are not going to have a very good reproductive year, maybe even more than a year, where they're not having successful reproduction. And the truth is, Mark, and I know this is frustrating for everybody, but the truth is we don't really know what that's going to mean for the populations yet, and we may not know for a long time. These animals take 10 or 20 years till they get old enough to reproduce until we can get to a point where we can really assess the impacts on these populations. It could be a matter of years.
We're talking with Jackie Savitz, Senior Campaign Director for Pollution Campaigns at Oceana, which is the largest international organization focused solely on ocean conservation. You can link to that group as we talk by going to steinershow.org. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Or go right to their site, and there's lots of things on their site. It's simply na.oceana.org. 410-319-88 is number here, and 8888, excuse me. And David, in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Mark?
Hi, David. Welcome.
Okay. I just got a couple of comments. I retired about 3 or 4 years ago, and I fell in love with talk radio a long time ago. So since I've retired, I've been able to listen to a lot more of it and listen to the cable stations. It seems like everyone has an agenda, and the people who come on these stations only give one side of the problem, and no one seems to want to look at the good and the bad and give you a real truthful statement. I heard a guy earlier today on one of the cable stations said that 40% of the oil that's being spilled will evaporate. You know, just automatically evaporate, you know, through the air as it comes up. He said a lot of it will be skimmed off and burnt off. So what I'm trying to say is that it seems like some people are taking the worst case scenario that could ever happen, and they come on and they're scaring the hell out of people. You know, one of the stations keeps showing one of the reporters down there dipping his hand in oil with a glove. And it's one little area. Earlier today, they said only 3 beaches have been affected by this. They're trying to get people that normally come down there for vacation to continue to come down there because the other beaches haven't been affected. But it seems like it's such a scare tactic, and it's not only with this oil spill, with everything that's going on. You know, we get people that come on that are supposed to be experts, but they all seem to have an agenda. And they give the worst case scenario.
Okay, well, Jackie, I mean, we often have many sides in this program.
Sure.
We don't often hear the environmentalist side on most media. We wanted to hear what the folks like Jackie have to say to us. But Jackie, why don't you respond to David?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a fair point. People have different perspectives on things. A couple things I can say. One is, if I wanted to share the worst-case scenario, I would tell you that the turtles were going to go extinct or that the bluefin tuna would become extinct. They might, but I didn't say that because we don't really know that for sure. We're going to have to wait and see. Rather, I tried to paint a picture of what kinds of issues these animals are going to be coping with, how it fits into their life history. The fact of the matter is, you know, we just came back from a hearing on the Hill where we sat next to the American Petroleum Institute, British Petroleum, and Transocean. I'm sure you've heard of Transocean. We all have a different perspective. But the thing to keep in mind is they're up there to defend their profits and their continued business operations as a corporation. That's what they have to do for their shareholders. Groups like Oceana, we're trying to defend the environment, which is a public resource which we all share, which we want to leave to our grandchildren. And so it's not about my profit. I'm not going to make any more money if I convince you of my way of thinking of things, but I might be able to leave a cleaner environment for future generations. And it's a David and Goliath battle. So I think you do have to definitely have to listen to what's the source of the information that I'm getting and run it through a filter and then decide if you think that the person bringing the information has an agenda that you disagree with or that you think is slanting what they're trying to tell you.
And if you want, you can go to deepwater.com, which is Transocean's website. And you've just inspired me now, and maybe we should have this debate and conversation on the air about with maybe Jackie and others and Transocean talking about the future of our energy and drilling. It would probably be good for our listeners to hear all that. And I think we have producers across the glass to listen to me make that commitment. So we'll go ahead and do that very quickly.
Be happy to do that.
I'm sure. David, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate you giving us a little spur. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
And hi, Clarence.
To you, yes. To me, it's not really a question of when will we make a conversion to a cleaner energy environment, but whom is in the way. Your guest stated that it's a David and Goliath battle, and we, the public, are really the Davids, and the rock that we have to throw is going to be with the vote, because we have to find some way to take the money coming from oil companies out of the politics and just stop having the politicians vote against our interests and the interests of the environment. And there's another issue that no one ever really talks about, is the intellectual property. There are a lot of inventions and things that are useful in this purpose that have just been bought up by large corporations and put on the shelf to prevent them ever being mass-produced that would make them available. There has to be some way to change the patent laws where, if it's in the interest of us all and the planet, that you can just not shelf an invention and say, hey, I'm just going to keep this for myself, and I'm not, because I don't want to lose any money by it being made applicable to the public.
Good thought. Do you have thoughts on that, Jackie?
Yeah, I think you bring up a very good point that is rarely thought about, and that's the fact that when we talk about a shift away from fossil fuels, and people say, oh, but you can't do that because, you know, there are jobs involved, people are making money at it. The truth is, we're not going to shift away from energy. We're going to go from one type of energy to another. Clean energy can create about 3 times more jobs for the same size investment than fossil fuels, traditional fossil fuels would. And so when we talk about stopping drilling and starting, for example, offshore wind, there's not a net job loss. There's actually a net job gain, because offshore wind will generate more jobs. We looked at the offshore wind potential in the Atlantic coast, and we compared it to the potential for drilling, because, you know, there's been a lot of interest in drilling in the Atlantic coast. Even President Obama was talking about that back at the end of March. And we found that if you invest the same amount of time that you're going to spend in the drilling process, which is going to be at least 20 years before we're really producing oil in the Atlantic, and you instead spend that time building offshore wind, we found that you could create more energy for less money, create more jobs, and actually be helping the climate change problem, which, of course, is being driven by our use of fossil fuels, and never have a spill. So if we could spend the same amount of money to create more energy and more jobs, why would we ever want to invest in the dirtier, less effective technology of offshore drilling for oil and gas? So again, I think that the point is, we're not talking about stopping using energy. We're talking about moving to a new kind of energy, which also requires workers and also will keep our lights on.
I wonder, you know, Lisa Jackson, who is the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, said to Congress, I think it was Wednesday last week, that she was pressing the BP for release of more test results. And the samples taken by boats that are under contract with British Petroleum. How much has been released? Why do you think BP doesn't want it released or is not releasing it? And what are the kinds of things that could be found? What would we know if that information was released?
Well, what's going to happen when this is all said and done, and I hope that starts tonight, I hope, is the government is going to do what's called a natural resource damage assessment, which means they're going to go out and determine, you know, how many fish do we think they killed? How many turtles do we think they killed? You know, how long will it be before the seagrasses or the wetlands recover? How many acres of wetlands were destroyed? And they'll do an assessment based on a baseline that they know what it looked like before the spill. And then they're going to charge BP to replace those natural resources. And this is actually a legal requirement. It's called a natural resource damage assessment. And so the better job the government does, the better they do at assessing the loss and how many, you know, animals, for example, are lost, the more it will cost BP. So it's not necessarily in BP's interest to help the government answer those questions. Now, I think the government will force them to turn over their data. I think it's absolutely necessary that they turn over their data, but I can certainly understand why they're not so quick to do that.
And is this, you think this is going to happen? I mean, people ask the question, why hasn't the federal government kind of pushed for this information in a kind of sterner, faster fashion?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the reality is this is going to be a very long story, Mark. And,
yeah.
You know, when you look at the Exxon Valdez and how many years it took when they went through all those lawsuits and Exxon fought tooth and nail about what they owed or didn't owe, and ultimately there was a decision, and then that decision was overturned. And I'm sure, in spite of everything we're hearing from BP, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of litigation around this, and it's going to take a long time before we're ever sort of finished trying to assess the damages from BP.
It's going to take a long time for people who do have damages, whether it's the fishermen or the businesses there, or to even collect a dime.
It's that's a whole other set of damages that BP is theoretically under the Oil Pollution Act actually has a liability limit of $75 million for those types of damages. And there's a number of members of Congress who are very concerned about that. And in fact, I saw Donna Edwards speaking about this recently. And there's a number of bills now where they're trying to increase that liability limit from $75 million to $10 billion, because $75 million to the oil industry is just, you know.
They made $15 billion in profit last year, the one company.
Yeah, $17 million is like pennies to us. So so that's something that needs to change.
Well, we will have this debate with Transocean and others on the air very soon. And I see my producer's laughing across the glass. There goes Mark committing again, but yes, we'll do it.
Before they commit to do it.
They'll do it. They're great. They're great producers. I'm lucky. Jackie Savitz, Senior Campaign Director for the Pollution Campaigns at Oceana. Thank you so much for taking time with us once again.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Look forward to having you back.
Likewise.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
The Mark Steiner Show, I will remind you, is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. When we return, we'll be joined by Crystal Hayes, who's an anti-racism activist. She's written a really interesting piece on racetalk.org, what really separates the Tea Party from the Black Panther Party. She's a daughter of Robert Seth Hayes, who is a member of the Black Panther Party who has been in prison since 1973. So stay with us for that. We'll be right back with that conversation. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Yesterday, on the way back from our meetings in the Eastern Shore and a new project we're all working on, I stumbled across this wonderful blog, an interesting blog, written by Crystal Hayes, What Really Separates the Tea Party from the Black Panther Party. And she wrote it as a response to someone who had written a piece that did just that, which she took umbrage with, and wrote a piece in response. And it went way beyond that. Crystal Hayes is an anti-racism activist, and she's author of the article I just talked about, which you can read at www.race-talk.org, which you can also link to on our website, steinershow.org. She's the daughter of Robert Seth Hayes, who was a member of the Black Panther Party, who's been in prison since 1973, and where he was convicted of murdering a police officer, a charge he denies, much like the story we hear in Baltimore and Maryland of Marshal Eddie Conway. And Crystal M. Hayes, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too, that you took the time. 410-319-8888 is our number here. Yeah, tell us about – I know we don't want – you wanted to talk a great deal about your work and your father, but that really is what spurred you on to write this piece in response to another piece. Talk a bit about what drove you to write this piece in the first place.
Wow. Well, what drove me to write the piece was just pure – you know, I was stunned, to be quite honest with you. The title obviously is very provocative. The author intended it to be that way. You know, the two have absolutely nothing to do with one another. So, I went from the range of emotions from being stunned to being furious to being sad and disappointed. You know, as you mentioned at the top of the show, my father has been incarcerated since 1973. So we're going on 38 years now, and, you know, what bugged me about that piece was I didn't want it to be the thing that was out there representing that particular era, representing the legacy of the Panthers, especially because my father is still deeply tied to that legacy. It was a very static piece. You know, it tried to reproduce, you know, all the provocative images of the Black Panther Party that speak to violent, you know, angry black men and black berets who are anti-government. And the Black Panther Party was so much more than that. And they evolved over, you know, the course of their organization. So I didn't want that piece that was published to be the thing that represented that legacy. So that's why I chose to respond.
And when you wrote in your first paragraph, that's what really caught me, obviously, was this first sentence you wrote. When you wrote, "I was 3 years old when I watched my father, mother, and three-week-old baby brother nearly murdered in a hail of bullets during a police raid on our home in September 1973.
That's right.
That's a hell of a thing for a three-year-old to experience.
Yeah, and, you know, just a full disclaimer, I have no actual intellectual memory of that day,
mm-hmm.
but I have the memory of being told about that day, and I have the memory of reading the newspaper articles. I mean, anybody right now could go to their public library and look up in the New York City papers the month of September in that year, and you put in, you know, you look for, you know, my father's name, and you'll see several different articles. I believe the New York Post ran an article, the Daily News had an article, and there was another paper that has the article. And, you know, after, you know, I grew up, you know, in prison with my dad. I visited with him, you know, for as long as I can remember. As a little girl, you know, I've probably been in every maximum and minimum security prison in New York State because, you know, they move them around, you know, after a period of time. And, you know, talking to him about, you know, what that was like, what happened. I mean, you're curious. You want to know what happened to your family. You want to know why is your father in prison. That's a very painful thing for any young person to hold. And so when I got older, I got curious, and I looked up the articles myself. And so my memory of that day isn't the actual intellectual memory of a three-year-old, but it's my memory from talking to family and reading about it in the papers.
But you grew up with a legacy.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, we've done a lot of shows about this legacy with other people, and just recently with Tanya Robinson about her new wonderful movie, which is about Panthers trying to come to grips with life after the Black Panther Party. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about what it is like for you as a young woman who deals with, makes a living as a job working around issues of race and racism, to think about where America has come to and not come to since the incarceration of your father.
Right. Well, you know, we have definitely come a long way. You know, there's no doubt about that. You know, I'd be the first to admit that we've made a tremendous amount of progress. I mean, I wouldn't be here on this phone with you now if that weren't the case. But, you know, we can say that while also holding, you know, the shadow part of that, which is, you know, we still have so much further to go. You know, we are incarcerating more people in the United States than any other industrialized nation in the world. You know, more men in prison are disproportionately men of color. You know, we have, you know, black women. I just read an article not too long ago that talked about the earning potential for black women, and those rates are still really abysmal. I mean, it just cuts across every sector, healthcare, it cuts across income levels, it cuts across education. I mean, so there's still a lot of work that we have to be done, even though we have made, you know, a tremendous amount of progress. And I think one of the things, you know, that we need to begin to look at is, you know, freeing folks, you know, from prison like my dad, you know, who was incarcerated, you know, during a time in this history, during a time in this country. We were having, we were battling huge questions around, you know, who we want to be as a nation. You know, this was at the height of the civil rights movement. This was, you know, the Black Power movement. there were all these conflicts happening between the state and the community. You know, COINTELPRO campaign was a big part of this. And so I think if we ever want to get to a place where we resolve some of those questions, you know, as they relate to who we want to be as a nation, we have to look back at that past by saying, okay, maybe it's time for people like my dad and others like him to come home.
Let's talk about that. I think you raised an important issue that I want to kind of lead into. But first, I want you to talk a bit about your father. Tell us about Robert Seth Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your dad and his story.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, I'm biased.
I'm sure you are. He's your father. I mean, wait, come on.
I mean, I'm biased. He's my father. But, you know, I was just sharing with someone the other day on the phone how, you know, one of the qualities I don't think I've inherited from him is, you know, his ability to get over stuff really, really fast. I mean, for somebody to be in prison for as long as he's been in prison, there is not an inkling of bitterness in his body. He is one of the most loving and generous and compassionate human beings that you would ever want to meet. And I'm not just saying that because I'm his daughter. I think that if you talk to anybody who knows him, they would say the same thing. And I've also watched him evolve, you know, over the course of his incarceration, you know, in terms of, you know, politically, you know, how he thinks about, you know, some of the things that were happening, you know, in his late teens, early 20s, and where he is today as a man. I mean, he's a grandfather now. You know, he's just an amazing human being. I can't say enough positive things about him.
There are a lot of guys I know who were in the Panthers, who, and some of whom are still in jail, like Marshall Eddie Cotton.
Just one other thing I wanted to say.
Oh, no, go ahead.
This is something that really is deeply important to me. One thing that I really want people to understand about him that is something that I will hold on for the rest of my life is, you know, through his incarceration, he still maintained his responsibilities and his rights as a parent. You know, when all of this stuff went down with the family and the arrest, we were separated. We were separated from obviously from him. He was in jail, and then we were separated from my mother. And then at some point, we ended up in foster care. And in all of that, he still fought to be a father. And I am convinced that the only reason why I can stand here today is because he made sure that there was contact. He made sure there was visits. He made sure to write all the time. He made sure to send money whenever he had. I don't know how he was able to send money. I would just get checks in the mail to cover certain things. And, you know, if you know anything about, you know, wages in prison, that's really hard to do. But he was able to manage all of that. And that is critically important, especially for a kid of an incarcerated parent, because the risk of children of incarcerated parents, you know, falling off the beaten path is so much greater for other kids. And, you know, studies have shown that, you know, kids who have that positive relationship with their parents do better, you know. And that's not to say that we haven't had trouble over the years, because certainly we have. But the fact that he has stuck in there with me has made a huge difference on my life.
And he's been there for 23 years now, right?
No, he's been in prison for 37.
37 years.
Yeah, so I'm 40. I was 2 when all of this went down. So my entire relationship with him, with my father, is behind prison walls. So I grew up behind prison walls as far as I'm concerned.
And I was going to, again, I'd like to get our listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. I'm going to posit an idea. I'd like to see what people out there think about this. And this half hour with Crystal Hayes, who wrote this piece, What Really Separates the Tea Party from the Black Panther Party, in response to something else. You can find it on racetalk.org, 410-319-8888. Crystal Hayes is an anti-racism activist, trainer, and writer. And we're talking about many things, but her father, Robert Seth Hayes, who has been in prison now 37 years. And I a couple of things. Is what struck me is your dad was a Vietnam vet as well, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And like many guys who were in the Panthers, he was a Vietnam vet and a wounded combat veteran.
That's right. And he had all kinds of awards and commendations.
And so there are a number of men and women who are still in jail from the 60s.
Right.
All over this country. Mm-hmm. Your father's one of them, and we can I can name a dozen off the top of my head. And so people would say, well, look, these men are convicted of murdering police officers. That's why they're in prison.
Right.
And it's also, though, to set up that time. If I'm your father's generation, so they're setting up the time of what that period was like when there was a war going on, not just in Vietnam, but there's a war going on in the streets of America, and that members of the Black Panther Party and members of the American Indian Movement and a number of other groups in this country were being attacked and being murdered by the police and by thugs who were close to the police. It happened across America. And these men and women are still in jail. So I wonder what you think and what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. Is it time to think about freeing people like Robert Seth Hayes and Eddie Conway and Leonard Peltier and all the others and begin some kind of truth and reconciliation commission in America and for all to take part, the police who did the killings as well as the men and women who are in jail? I mean, something happened then and we're kind of – and these men could die and languish in this prison.
And you know, they can die and languish in prison, and there still won't be any healing. And that's what I meant earlier when I said, you know, we're still grappling with the question of what kind of nation we really want to be. And, you know, I think, you know, for the most part, you know, we're good. We're good people. We believe that, you know, everybody should have opportunities to thrive and do well and, you know, see their kids grow up and thrive and do well. And that we shouldn't, you know, lock people up indefinitely when there are opportunities for rehabilitation. I mean, my father's been in prison for 37 years with no, you know, he hasn't reoffended during that entire time. He's been a mentor. He has done, you know, all kinds of trainings and finished school. He took college courses. You know, I mean, he's done everything that the, you know, the Department of Corrections, you know, says you're supposed to do in order to achieve parole at some point. And yet that's still not happening. So, you know, we're really hopeful that at some point it will.
And listeners, what do you think? 410-319-8888. Should these people be freed? Should there be some kind of truth and reconciliation commission in America to address this? There's another woman who's a friend of mine who also was serving life in prison and actually was close to the group and probably knew your father as well, Marilyn Buck.
Yes.
And she is in prison in West Virginia and has become a Buddhist and is leading peace movements inside of jail and counsels other women.
Right.
She was a marvelous person back then and still is today. So, you know, I mean, this is something I think that America, it's an unknown story that we really, I think America might take heart to and start listening to and thinking about what we can do and how to address this.
Right. And I mean, this is one of the reasons why, just to get back to your earlier question.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Why I wanted to respond to that initial article, you know, was because, you know, it was this sort of, you know, we really need to sort of get beyond, you know, these attitudes, you know, that continue to keep us, you know, frozen in time. You know, this sort of static creation of the Panthers as being this, you know, angry mob of black men who were anti-government was just simply not true. They were, you know, they believed in coalition building. You know, they believed in working with, you know, gay and lesbian groups, with white groups, with other people of color. They believed in doing anti-oppression work. And they also believed that the U.S. government had a role, you know, to play in making sure that, you know, their citizens, you know, were safe, had access to decent housing, had quality education, and had full employment. And there was a shift, you know, in their thinking. You know, their political strategy began to change over time. Again, I mean, they, you know, are thinking human beings, too, who said, you know, wait a minute, something is not right here. This is not working. We need to rethink the way that we're approaching, you know, some of these problems. And maybe, you know, we need to start saying, okay, we need to move away from the black nationalists, the confrontations with police, because it's just counterproductive. It's not working. And that was not at all appreciated. I mean, in the article, he chose to list a couple of those comments, but he was, you know, he was persistent in just dismissing them over and over and over again, you know, to link the two things together. And I just thought that was just a, you know, it wasn't a fair characterization.
Let's open the phones as we talk with Crystal M. Hayes, 410-319-8888. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi,
Pam. Welcome.
Hi, is it Crystal?
Yes.
Hi. How are you? And is it Mark?
Yes.
Okay. I've called in before. I just wanted to make a comment in reference to the whole reconciliation, like where we are now versus where we were when your father was arrested. I mean, at the time, I've heard people mischaracterize the Black Panthers. Black Panthers even today because of the climate that we're in. But when you think about what Mark said about the police, I mean, the people who were enforcing the law, it just think about the law before change with Jim Crow and all that. I mean, you as a people of color, thank God we had Martin Luther King. I mean, it's like if you don't do anything, you are oppressed. And then if you stand up for yourself or people in general, then you're mischaracterized. It's okay for white people to be angry, mob-like the Tea Party is, but if you are a person of color, it's you're anti-American and the whole thing. And the thing I'm going to say about the whole reconciliation thing, when President Obama was running, and I campaigned very heavily for him, when he was running for president and he talked about us coming together, black, white, brown, you know, Asian, it didn't matter. Us coming together and resolving those issues that our nation lives with, a lot of us bought into that, black and white. We believed it and we were ready for it because all anyone wants in this country is to be validated. But there's a segment in the far right side of this country who really believes in that whole taking our country back to Jim Crow. If you listen to Rand Paul, who's a libertarian, what he said about the Civil Rights Act, he can backpedal it and all that, but he firmly believes that it should be okay to discriminate people based on their skin color if you're a private business owner. I mean, so, it's like taking a step forward and 10 steps backwards.
Right.
Crystal?
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you for that. You know, one of the things that is really apparent to me is that we need to have the conversation. I mean, that's why I do this work now. I'm open for us to debate these issues. I'm open for us to push each other, you know, but what I'm not open for is folks to, you know, completely revise history. And the trouble that I have with Rand Paul's assertion that, you know, private businesses should be allowed to discriminate based on race is he completely overlooks the fact that, you know, segregation, you know, happened hand in hand with violence. You know, it's not as if these things happened in a vacuum. Those two things went together. And so if you're going to tell me that, you know, the way that he makes the argument, it appears really clean and innocuous. We don't have, you know, it's just the way that things should be because these are private businesses, you know, is foolishness. And, you know, we need to challenge that. We need to talk about it. We need to make sure that they don't ban ethnic studies in schools because it's another reason why people are not going to know, you know, how to challenge these issues because they're not even going to know, have access to the history to understand what, you know, this country was like before compared to what it is today and how people are trying to set back the hands of time 50, 60, 100 years. You know, if we allow them to revise history in this way. So, yeah, you know, I'm all for that.
Thank you, Pam, for your call. Let's get another caller in here, 410-319-8888. And I want to turn to talk a bit more about Robert Seth Hayes and Pete in Columbia. You're on the air. Hi, Pete, you there?
Great to hear the show again. I was out of the country for a few weeks and missed it a great deal.
Well, welcome back.
When the Obama campaign was on, I volunteered up in Pennsylvania with what time I had and then gave about 5 or 10 times as much money to that campaign than I'd ever given to any other. And when he was elected, I was thrilled and thought now maybe Leonard Peltier, would get, a pardon, would get fair treatment because I never believed that that he should have been in prison. And your description of why it was that people were defending their communities, I thought was an apt one. And I'm really terribly disappointed at this point. I know he came into office with an enormous amount of problems on his plate, and to have even more to deal with could be difficult. And to deal with something where you're really taking on a federal law enforcement agency and saying, we don't agree with the decision you made a few decades ago. And I only listened, I was only able to tune into the show late, and I heard you mention Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I think we're way overdue for that, for Leonard Peltier and the others that you mentioned.
And let me thank you so much for that call, Pete. I'd be remiss if we didn't come back and kind of close out a little bit here and talk more about Robert Seth Hayes and the inspiration he gave you as your dad, and a bit of his story and where and how he's doing now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, he's dealing with some health challenges, which is one of the other reasons why, you know, it's, you know, really important that he get to come home. But other than that, his spirits are up. He has set into motion a set of appeals, so he is challenging the parole board process. And so, you know, there's some good folks who are working, you know, working on that and taking care of that for him. And, you know, we're just hopeful. You know, I wanted to do this show with you tonight, and I wanted to write that article, you know, again, because I want us to, you know, start to shift our thinking a little bit, because I think as long as we, you know, continue to maintain, you know, these outdated, archaic ideas of what the Black Power Movement was about, who those folks were, you know, as if they weren't, you know, human beings with families and kids, and they didn't care about the same things that everybody else cares about, you know, we don't have any hope for seeing, you know, these folks come home. You know, folks like Leonard Peltier, folks like Marilyn Buck, and folks like my dad. So I just think it's time for us to be honest, and I think it's time for us to do some healing. I think this is I think we're in a perfect moment. You know, they say you're in a fork in the road, you know, and, you know, you have a choice to make. You know, we can either keep going down the same worn-out path to nowhere, or we can say, you know, we're ready to really change our identity, you know, as a country and do the right thing. And, you know, President Reagan did this. You know, I can't remember all the facts and details, but, you know, there were some FBI agents who were attached to COINTELPRO campaign that he pardoned, you know, and I'll look it up, and it is on record where he said, you know, the reason for his decision was because he felt like we needed to heal from that era. We needed to heal from that history. Well, if it's true for them, it's true now.
Crystal Hayes, this has been, I'm glad I stumbled across your writing, and I'm very happy we're on the show and look forward to having you on as a guest more to talk about issues of the day.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and good luck with everything, and we'll certainly link to all your work on our website.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Take care. Crystal M. Hayes, you can go to racetalk.org and read what she's written, What Really Separates the Tea Party from the Black Panther Party, and link more to her father, the Free Seth Hayes campaign. You can do that as well on our website. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Division of Transplantation, where patients' lives are enhanced by renowned transplant programs known for innovation and excellence in kidney, liver, and pancreas transplants. For more information, call 1-800-492-5538. I will remind you that this weekend, Sunday, May the 30th, from noon to 9 p.m., come celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Suibo Fest. Sweet performers, food, beer, wine, exciting musical performances, the Grace International Church, the Remnants, and many more. It takes place all day at the historic Holland Street Market. For more information, you can visit www.soeboarts.org/festival. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite. This month, Urbanite explores the city's contemporary art scene and prospects for leveraging this cultural energy into a force for broader community change. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of pickup locations. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, produced by Justin Levy and Christina Arison, engineered by Brian Boone. Interns are Judith Floyd, Richard Good, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, get information about our guests, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.